Hello, Capital Region. This is WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. For the week of Thanksgiving 2020, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is taking time off. Instead of our regular news program, we're playing original, pre-recorded content throughout the week. HMM will resume on Monday, November 30th at 6 p.m. On today's program, HMM producer Anna Staltenkamp speaks with Myron Dewey. Myron Dewey is a filmmaker, journalist, digital storyteller, and the founder of Digital Smoke Signals, a media production company that aims to give a platform to Indigenous voices in media. He co-directed the award-winning 2017 film, Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, which tells the story of the No Dapple movement and the Native-led peaceful resistance and fight for clean water, the environment, and the future of the planet. This is Myron Dewey.
Hala na ahoba shanami na agaitika na tabona nia Myron Dewey na agaitika diapa na poni'i awake director. My name is Myron Dewey, and I'm currently on the Paiute Nation territory out here in Nevada, and I am one of two directors of one of the three directors of Awake documentary, filmed at a visual legal narrative to protect water protectors at Standing Rock during 2016, protecting the water against the Dakota Access Pipeline, trying to put a pipeline underneath the water and through their burial sites.
Will you describe your personal experience at Standing Rock and how your position as both a media maker and Native participant defined your experience at and altered your understanding of the protests?
It was very easy. And I'll start with this, is whenever I met somebody, I would ask them if they knew the land that they were on, which people the lands that they're on. So I'll start with an example. Which land do you currently live on, the Indigenous people's land?
Yes. So for Duke University, which I'm a student for, and that's where I am right now, our land acknowledgement is, I acknowledge that the space in Greater University gathers on land that has long served as the site of meeting and exchange amongst a number of Indigenous peoples, historically the Shikori and Catawba people. I honor and respect the diverse Indigenous peoples connected to this territory on which we gather. And then for the Sanctuary for Independent Media, which is where Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasts, it is with gratitude and humility that I acknowledge that the Sanctuary for Independent Media resides upon and broadcasts from the ancestral homelands of the Mohican people, who are Indigenous peoples of the lands of New York. Despite tremendous hardships and being forced from their lands, today their community resides in Wisconsin and is known as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I pay honor and respect to their ancestors, past and present.
And that's the start right there. Not so much rehearsed and read and scripted, but actual acknowledgement. And that was the start of checking in the media, and people that were getting media passes during that time was doing Indigenous 101, educating about why they were here, what their intentions were, and if they were in solidarity, and also completely not knowing about Indigenous issues or the stories or anything, was debunking a lot of Western media right on the spot completely. People came out who didn't even know tribes existed, couldn't believe it, couldn't believe it, that this is what they were seeing on social media, and they had to come out and see for their own two eyes. And I, for the first 3 months, I checked in the media. I checked in everyone that came through camp that got a media pass and created digital protocols, when and when not to film. There was a lot of ceremonies happening. And this was different than any other movement across the country in history, because of the fact that you have Indigenous people articulating why water was sacred. And what we were seeing, there was a lot of patience in communicating that with people that were coming. And we're born of water. It's It's very simple for us. We're born of water, and that's why water is sacred. And that's why we protect Mother Earth, because Mother Earth has the water that we drink. And what we are seeing on the other side of that fence and that pipeline was that these men have forgot they were born of water. And so that land wasn't as sacred to them. Also, they have no connection to the land. So it's that was documenting that desecration of burial sites, sacred sites. It was constant articulating indigenous history. And that was the moment to do it, because the law enforcement also had no idea that they were on broken treaty land, which at that time, Kyle Kirschmeyer was constantly being told. And down the road, history will, I hope, will hopefully hold them accountable and educate law enforcement on these treaty responsibilities. But that was at that time, there was so much educating happening. It was coming in all these different directions, different questions. And indigenous media was very important there, as well as the narrative being an indigenous narrative, because when the indigenous narrative changes and it's no longer an indigenous narrative through indigenous lens, then the optics change and the scenario of the story changes and the language of the words change. And I've seen that happening several times. I can tell when there's liberal media and you know, propaganda media and indigenous media, it just felt like a time warp in history of what my ancestors didn't have at that time to articulate the Indian Wars. And as simple as the terminology war drums being used, we have no war drums, nor is it in our language to have war drums. Same thing with war bonnets. Tribes don't have war bonnets. They have bonnets. They're not meant for war. And Western media took that out of context, and it was still doing it. And there was things that were popping up like 150 years to the week. It was a massacre over cows that were killed, supposedly being killed. It was also brought back up in the media again by Bismarck Media, which we debunked quick. And the farmer did find his cows. Then they try to say that the camp was killing buffalo. And, you know, it's very clear that they knew that those farmers were spraying poison to kill rodents, which did kill some buffalo, as documented. And these were the constant attacks through media that were being used as propaganda media to stir up the community. And it wasn't until drones and live feeds that there was only visual accountability. And that was the goal. My goal was to do as much training and digital storytelling training, because our historical trauma was consistent. This has happened to all our tribes across the United States: Western encroachment, Western media, corporate, land theft. Broken treaties, just a continuance. There's so much to list, but it was happening right now in real time. And so I did what I could to try to educate as much as possible on the history, but also, you know, create community journalists. So it can be an indigenous narrative through indigenous eyes. And we are here to share our story, and we're no longer invisible. And so we got to articulate that story as well, the best we can.
Can you expand upon that notion of indigenous voices sharing their own narrative, speaking about the importance of Native peoples becoming media makers and having the tools to share their own stories through their own voices and perspectives, perhaps describing the efforts of your media company, Digital Smoke Signals?
Digital Smoke Signals started back in 2000. I've been working with the youth for over 20 years. Historical trauma from loss of land, loss of language, forced loss of dignity, indoctrination, intellectual manipulation through Western media. And it comes from the boarding school era. And the history also comes from dime nickel magazines, where we're misrepresented in those old stories, as well as documented history from the United States government to wax cylinders that misrepresented our language and our songs, being directed on the pitch of those songs, which changed a lot of tribes' songs, to Curtis Edwards and photography misrepresenting us and really addressing the photograph to fit the narrative that he saw fit with different tribes in different regalia that wasn't a part of their tribe, to Hollywood romanticizing romanticizing indigenous people in Hollywood, the different eras of us becoming savages to the noble Indian, to all of a sudden Dances with Wolves, where, you know, white savior comes in and all of a sudden becomes the better Indian and saves all the Indians. There's stories like that that I've seen, such as The Last Samurai. Tom Cruise, he does the same thing in there. And as I seen Hollywood be a part of the American Indian movement during that time and open up that platform to try to make that wrong right, I saw that there were directors and producers in there and filmmakers that were very conscious and very woke. And as Standing Rock started, that support came in again. And but this was different. This generation had media outlets in their hand with every live feed, with every social media outlet. And so what I seen was they were no longer the media. We were the media, and we can have the exact same audience as they could, except the world is watching through indigenous eyes, through an indigenous lens. And I can articulate it without having to do Indigenous 101 to those guys. And so after a frustrating 3 months of having to do that with every single media to educate, I started just walking through camp, training everybody on doing live feeds. And we have a consistent narrative from land removal, water contamination, sterilization of our indigenous women, to the lack of trust responsibility with the federal government, to alcoholism, addiction. We have nutritional genocide, which is done through the commodities, to being removed into the city, relocation, boarding school. There was so many of the consistent issues. It was not, I didn't have to really do anything but train them to do digital protocols. And I walked from teepee to teepee, tent to tent, fire to fire, stand to stand, frontline, all ever, just to share your narrative, share your story. If you don't have the language, share why. Articulate it and help those that are watching understand why we're here. Because when it's seen collectively through an indigenous lens, then it was an indigenous narrative. And the historical trauma is consistent from Western encroachment. It's Americans who have no clue living guilt-free on indigenous lands. And then I saw when the guilt hit, and then the white savior would hit. But it's like, what we need is white allies and using that white privilege, because the white privilege comes from all of the atrocities. And so I heard different stories from different allies. It's like, well, I feel like you're attacking me, Myron. And I'm like, well, I'm not, I'm just sharing with you history.
Right.
And I can't tell you what you feel, but you benefit from the genocide. You benefit from the land theft. You benefit from all those things that were stolen and taken and promised, and the removal. And it is hard to sit with. And that's why our indigenous history is invisible to you, because your gurus and your healers and your psychologists tell you, focus on today and not the past. Let's move forward. And that's history. That's Western history. That's Western healing right there. But there's so many complications when it comes in. It's like, what do you mean this land wasn't free? What do you mean my religion caused sexual abuse and pain with these people? What do you mean my family's politicians and they don't honor any of those missing, murdered indigenous women policies that we try to put through, or the violence against women? And it's like, those were the constant questions that were coming over and over and flooding. And so the historical trauma comes from having to regurgitate this trauma. And so I decided 20 years ago I needed to learn how to articulate it better without getting so emotional and start the healing process. So education is important because the education was used to indoctrinate Indigenous people. Now let's use that to decolonize and start the healing process. And for my community, I try to enlighten and empower our people instead of educate them, because we need to heal. And if we can come together, both of our relatives on both sides, our Native and non-Native relatives, then we can start that healing process. But until then, we're going to continue to see that resistance from Americans, that denial and of white privilege and occupying Indigenous lands guilt-free. And so when we stand up, it's like, oh, what are them Indians doing? They don't know. And their ignorance comes forward, and their racism comes forward, and what they've learned comes forward. And so it's been constant, constant decolonizing allies and re-educating as much as possible with patience. And that's what we're able to do with media differently in social media, is to articulate through Indigenous eyes. But as I shared with you earlier, the thing that I worry about is the language. The language in Western media is criminalizing our Indigenous people. And so when we go harvest our traditional foods, we are no longer harvesting on our lands. We're now trespassing on our own lands. And so when we stand up to that, now we're protesting. And if they're doing deforestation, that's considered protesting, because that's how it was in my homelands here in Paiute territory, is that they're doing deforestation of our pine nut trees. And the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and then we find out later that this is a decade project, generational impact to expand the bombing range for all the military branches. So my tribe, being occupied by military since first contact, historically, the tribes that stood up and said, no, this ain't okay, are the ones that got the forts by them to keep the Indians in check and also starve them from their food source. And just like the buffalo almost got wiped out, my tribe 100% lost its trout in Walker Lake, its food source. We're called the Gaitika, trout eaters. And this is the history. And it's repeating itself. There's no accountability. And we're at a point now that worries me from the military-industrial complex that I document in my own community since first contact, is we witness the contamination of water that's not drinkable down to the surface. And then we witness corporations coming in, Anaconda Mine, which is the largest Superfund site on this side of the in Nevada, which contaminated the first aquifer. And then we witness corporate farming come in, agricultural cleansing, and use that groundwater to do organic farming in Uinta, Nevada. And then we have to the east a mine that is extracting water for their silver and minerals that they're extracting. And then to the northwest is the bombing range 7 miles from my home. And then to the south is the live munition as the lake recedes from not only climate change, but agricultural use. And live munition is starting to become a danger, which all around our lake from encroachment we no longer have is now military use, as well as our sacred mountain. So what I'm sharing here is just the truth that I see through my own experience. And it's not hard, because in the place that has the highest technology on the planet, my tribe is still in a digital divide. And when this COVID hit, many of our tribal members had no way to get online. And why are we still in that digital divide? I can only imagine through Western cultures and Homeland Security, and the things that history shows is that they're scared of communication and their own communication. And so there's some type of threat that comes up from Homeland Security. And so we are in the middle of the infrastructure. So if we get technology, I'm assuming they're worried that their enemy will come in and be able to have access to that technology. And that's just Western history right there. That's a repeated history. So when I'm documenting the Dakota Access Pipeline, I know we're going to deal with FBI, We're going to deal with different agencies. We're going to deal with Homeland Security. We're going to deal with U.S. Marshals, because they're tribes. They're going to be federal agents coming in, because we're under the federal agencies, as well as their own Bureau of Indian Affairs, tribal police. I know this because I'm watching it build, and I'm seeing a pattern as it did in my homeland within my lifetime, because there's nuclear storage in Nevada and our homelands in the Shoshone territory. And so it's just a constant repeat of history, and it was played out like a movie. It was so to the T, just like a movie. So documenting this through Indigenous Eyes was easy to hold accountable to the truth, to the human rights violations that happened on Backwater Bridge, to the constitutional violations of Americans, and also us as tribal members, because we're of dual citizenship. One of our tribal nations, or Indigenous tribes, to also the United States. And so there's got to be some accountability here, which at that time documenting, I could see that the North Dakota would also use the law enforcement to not hold themselves accountable to their own laws, because that happened the same thing in Nevada. And that's where we got Pinkertons and militia pushing through with the railroad and the mines. So that's how it became very apparent. We needed community journalism, and we need our relatives to share their truth through their own experiences, through Indigenous Eyes.
Can you speak a little more about, from your perspective, how one can be a white ally and what role a white ally has in the environmental movement, and how a white ally can respectfully engage in the cycles of reciprocity that are a part of our natural world? I know you stated the importance of accountability, recognition, and respect.
Mm-hmm. You know, after Standing Rock, I could see we had allies.
Mm.
I didn't feel it here in Nevada growing up. It felt like all Natives were against us. Like we were in their way. And the racism that was completely open and fell in Nevada with the military base there. And it just felt like through the education system and also the legal system, where a lot of our relatives were always incarcerated. So it just felt like we were always being held accountable for something that we didn't know was there. I didn't know was there until now. Now I can articulate it. We're the reminders of these broken promises. We're the reminders of this land and the atrocities and the land theft and the wrongdoings. And so what I seen at Standing Rock with allies is we had allies back then too. And the invisible of and media suppressed that. But this time it didn't. This time we're able to show 4,500 veterans to come and stand in solidarity, apologize for being on the wrong side of history, and came as allies to hold space in front of the front line with their training and accountability of themselves to be on the right side of history this time, as well as the churches. Over 550 different churches came from all over the country and around the world. And people, 550 people at that one time. I'm a historical trauma trainer. So when I was really curious to hear what they said, and when I went down there and they burned a mock-up of the Doctrine of Discovery, that was something very powerful for me. And they said, we came here to witness the right way to pray, not to witness to the Indigenous people, but witness the right way to pray. I was blown away. And I was very emotional watching that, because they went through a list of the sexual abuse that the churches have done, the wrongdoings of the federal government policies. They were very fluent in what was happening and apologized for standing by and watching it and also allowing their churches to participate in it. So to be an ally is to hold space in that trauma, to hold space in the horror of American history when it comes up, because now we can articulate the cause and effect. We can articulate the policies, the systematic racism, and also what it's doing to our relatives crossing the border. because we have the original immigrants now deciding who is an immigrant. It's ridiculous. Mm. And it's unreal. And it's changing the ecosystem. It's changing the way we eat, the way we are in relationship with the earth, and how in the relationship we are with each other. And the way the farming is going on with the killing of the land, it's like, I don't understand the concept that some of the farmers do, and they're disconnect from the land and killing it. Cause after they come in, they kill the land. It's obvious. And it's because they have no connection to the land, nor do they know the land. The land is alive. The dirt is alive. The rocks are alive. These are really simple things that we know in that relationship. So to be an ally is to hold that space. And everyone is different at different levels of healing, different levels of trauma, different levels of assimilation and indoctrination, and also intellectual manipulation through education. So it's hard to sit with some allies sometimes. If you, like myself, I've sat with some older allies who knew my history, and I just held that space with them, because if their intentions were good and their heart was in the right place and their spirit, then I could hold that space. And I'm willing to hold that space now, because it keeps coming my way, that role, and I've accepted it. But I'm pretty honest about my whole life, I couldn't, because I couldn't articulate the anger at that time. Today I can. And when someone tells me what your teacher did last year, said, I don't see color. I'm like, you see color, because if you didn't, you would have mismatched your socks. You would have mismatched your socks. You know, you see color. Mm-hmm. You just haven't experienced it. And obviously you see color because you're matching. And there's something going on here. You know, mm-hmm. there's this deniability of that trauma. And she shared with me, she goes, you know what, Maya? And she goes, she was 79 years old. And she said, I apologize, because as you were telling me that, a story popped up when I was 7 years old of my grandpa who worked at the base in Hawthorne, Nevada. And he had told me a story that he got tired of building roads through burial sites. And he told me of a road on the Poline Road where it goes in a U around a large massacred burial site. And these are the stories allies have come forward and shared with me over the healing process. But you got to be, I think, in tune with that and ready to hold space, because that trauma, there is no descendants that we know of the Pagwidakata, of all of the munition that was the largest munition bunker on the planet back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, during those times. And we watched now and hear it from our homelands, munition detonating all the time. And those dangers come through our homelands on the railroad still. And so there's still an unaccountability going on. We need to hold them accountable, but we need Americans to say, when Veterans Day comes up, you know, start acknowledging it's not the veterans, thank you for your service. It's Indigenous people for the land that we're on. There's something else happening here. And I'm hearing that from veterans that told me out at Standing Rock. They're like, you know, there's a bigger picture that we haven't even just broke the surface to have that conversation. And so we need to hold that space together and continue the accountability to hold that space of American horror history and what has happened, and continue to educate. And that's what an ally does, is holds that space and uses their white privilege to write the language in a way that senators or people, representatives of their state or the school board, to include Indigenous history from the Indigenous people, not ethnohistorians, because we're here to articulate our history. We've got teachers, professors, we got doctors. Western medicine doesn't include our traditional medicines, which Western medicine came from. Where they're getting their recipes for their medicines is on our lands. Now we can start including that contribution to the foods, to the land, and also what we're seeing in the technology that we use. Those come from our lands. And as we move into this green way of thinking, that lithium is going to come from indigenous lands. And what we're going to hear is a new level of accountability for corporations trying to go green, because where's that waste going to go? As well as the mass that we're seeing build up. These mass are going to be the new plastic, and you're going to see them in trash everywhere. That's what we know in our homelands, because at one time we didn't have that. And all of a sudden there's an abundance of this. It's going to become a waste, a biohazard, if you will. And so tribes don't have the technology and tools to recycle those things. That's where we need allies. We need help with that.
On this note of enlightenment, empowerment, and healing, from your experiences at Standing Rock, what is specifically the importance of ceremony and kinship for Native healing in the face of the vast environmental degradation, cultural genocide, and ecocide that has occurred in the United States? And how do these forms of healing lead to empowerment, action, and positive change?
Do you have that answer?
I've spoken.
No, not spoken. Do you have that answer? That's tough, right?
Yeah.
It is. And you see, if you have struggled with that, you imagine the senators and politicians in the same place?
Yeah, I think it's important to have the coming together. And I think community is very important. And I think ceremony is fundamental from what I've understood through my own attempts to learn and educate myself of it's important as a mode of thanksgiving to the earth and recognizing the earth and source and the more than humans as gifts. And I think the coming together and sharing of those experiences can be empowering. And I think action when faced with these moments of environmental degradation and these systems that cause it, I think collective action and coming together and reconnecting with source and recognizing our places within the natural world, I think that's important. And I think So I think the coming together is important. And from what I understand from just witnessing it through your film, it felt that the coming together was very significant. I thought the circle of everyone coming together was very empowering for me to see. Mm-hmm.
It's it felt like it was possible. The impossible became possible. That's what it felt like. And when I talk about ceremony, you know, in the United States, it was illegal for indigenous people to sing songs. They were abused and disciplined extremely terrible through the boarding school process. And the Native American Religious Freedom Act was one of the steps into opening the door for us to practice openly. But we also have to protect that ceremony from people that use it as cultural appropriation, that don't understand the language, don't understand the regalia, don't understand the ceremony use, and don't understand also the sacred fire. An example of the sacred fire, when people were coming out to camp, we'd have to go over there and say, hey, you know, these are fires are sacred, and they're sacred because they're for the community, by the community. And also, you know, we have limited amount of wood. We have to think about everybody. So It's taking people away from the individual person to the community. And so the same process in the voting politically today, we vote here as a community because we're dual citizens. What affects us is which one of these leaders, Western leaders, are going to hold accountable their forefathers' promises to protect the land, the water, and the interests of our community, which basically are those, the natural law. And so ceremony is so important, but also those words in the federal government are like smoke. They have no meaning anymore. And that's what I worry about And so the people that came and stood with us as allies, you know, them holding that space, that's an ally. Became relatives. And they got to see how we lived together as human beings and how we took care of each other. They got to see that the indigenous people, there was no homelessness there. There was no hunger. There was medical attention. There was volunteers. It was something that was everyone, and it didn't matter who you were, who you believed in. You know, it was everyone was a part of that because we were protecting the water, which we were all born of.
Mm.
And that was the process of educating. And there's stories I just heard from many people that shared about their families, their history, their participation in oil, their participation in corporate takeover of indigenous lands. I mean, I heard hundreds of these stories. One story was her grandpa was a sniper in the military back when the immigrants were coming across and going into war against indigenous people. And his job was to sniper them because they did not want to kill women and children. They weren't killers. They weren't murderers. They came here for a better life. And this is what they were doing to survive. And these stories are American stories that have been suppressed in their own family to rewrite the attempt to rewrite history. And this is why we have problems in accountability when we go into the Senate and to Washington, D.C., is because they don't have these stories. Mind you, they know of it because mm-hmm. they've been told over the years, especially if they've been in there a long time. And so it's going to take constant education to decolonize and then to get the healing process so we can start empowering each other, through enlightenment. That's just my thought as a historical trauma trainer and also as an educator. And so we can start that healing of our DNA and move forward because there's no going backwards. I mean, we can't just say, poof, all the white people will be gone.
Mm.
You know, because then what will happen? Someone else is going to try to come and invade because that's the history now of the planet. And indigenous people are protecting 70% of the natural resources, which they still harvest. They still caretake, and they still have the relationship with the land. And so that's where we are today, still trying to hold on to that. Now, my homeland is different. We have no surface water to drink, the very top of that water like I did growing up, which probably was not healthy, but it was coming out of the streams of the mountains. And there is the places where I grew up fishing and drinking the water that came out no longer comes out of those mountains. So we are definitely seeing a change, and the next war is going to be the fight for water, clean drinking water.
From your perspective, how do white allies learn, be present, and participate in moments such as Standing Rock in ways that are respectful and reciprocal and aren't extractive of the knowledges?
I think it's relearning the history, relearning what it means to be an ally in many different layers when it comes to standing in solidarity. Sometimes there's that white ally who comes in and has a problem relinquishing their power in their eyes, because we understand how to do it traditionally the way we need to. And it could be a release of funds or support. The ally that comes in as a white savior, sometimes that's a lot of Hollywood guys, you know, wealthy people come in as white savior, and they need to be validated for their work. To me, it's not an ally. That's more of ego. And this is just my experience, you know, just sharing with you what I've come across. The entitlement part, that's the one that has to be included in everything, and felt like there's some type of entitlement that comes with that, as well as that white savior. And there's the solidarity part. I think the guilt, white guilt, is where people come in and have seen that white guilt when they realize the history, or they find out that their ancestors were oppressors, heavily oppressors. or land theft. And the something I seen and heard from individual people who have felt through some of the lectures that I've done around the country, I met one guy who came to me and he says, you know, I heard you say something that was very powerful. He says, if you're really sorry, if you really want to do some good, then the land that was land theft and stolen, why not gift it back to the tribe? And if it's a large amount of land, then why not take, just keep a portion for yourself, for your family, and come in and gift the rest back to the tribe and start the healing process of our DNA. And he said, he took my advice and he came down to Kansas doing a screening and told me he did that. And he said it was the best thing he's ever done because he knew that was land. It was land that through the Oklahoma land rush, the Sooners. And he shared with me his journey. And money is not the answer, although that's the system we live in now, because I worried about money that comes from when we reach a certain age. I didn't know it was from land theft. I didn't know it was from contamination of water. And so money kills our people too. Mm. And it causes addiction and suicide and very hurt. And not, that's not everybody. Some people understand how to use that tool and to, you know, improve their homes or improve their livelihood. So there's a vice versa here. So there's a lot of healing that we are doing around Native Americans, Native America, to our own relatives. Also educating the different terminologies, Indian country, indigenous lands, Native Americans, natives, and tribes. This is where land acknowledgement comes in. And the allies will hold that space to relearn, put aside the ego, and start to learn. And that's what I've also learned from just myself to hold space. And I don't have all the answers. I only have my experience. Mm. And there's times I get frustrated with some allies because they don't want to hold that space. They just want to give without accountability. And then we just go back to square one. And I feel like their heart's in the right place, but I ask them, you know, for some accountability so we can start the process where it's not the feeling of being taken advantage of. And that came through the legal system that they were helping water protectors. And imagine if we didn't have that much support with the 837 water protectors arrested, we would have had more than just 5 political prisoners. Mm. That's a lot that's arrested. And allies came in support from all around the planet, locally, and also young people from Bismarck. I spoke with a lot of students there and invested my time to hear their stories, ask their questions, and to give them courage to seek the answers so we don't get this repeated again. So I got hope in this next generation, but we got to take that time to empower them and give them courage to know the truth. Mm. And the truth is hard because we're still discovering all of the things from the Dakota Access Pipeline. It made me think about who was contracting with the boarding schools that were kidnapping our children. My uncle was one of them who has passed away a little over 3 weeks ago. He was 6 years old when he was kidnapped from Uinta, Nevada. He's Paiute and taken to the boarding school in Carson City. Who was contracting during those times? And there's some accountability we're still not seeing because those contracts were horrible in a time where our people didn't have the right to vote as we do today. So there's a lot of learning and healing. So white allies, use your white privilege to educate in your circles, educate other allies to be, to hold that space. And so let down the ego and be vulnerable and hold that space in pain so we can heal. And not everyone will want to hold that space. I know that for a fact, because the trauma is deep. Mm. So just have compassion and empathy.
And from my understanding of what you're saying, there's an importance in being active listeners. And I think of something that another person I interviewed, Janet McGillivray, spoke about, of this need to control the knowledge, and there's a narcissism in that, and we need to learn to be comfortable with the statement, I don't know, but someone else may, and may I learn from them. And I think in that regard of what you're speaking about, of the importance of learning and taking on the ally versus ego, of recognizing, let me not speak and let me rather listen and learn.
And you know, when I was at Duke, one of the things that we did in trying to get the students and a place in there was something that was really interesting, is they wanted to give us a space of statues around campus. And I felt like, well, that holds us in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for the future here today. And that time will come. But for now, our students need the equal treatment on their own homelands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still yet to come. I would encourage you, if you haven't, to go down and visit them and let them know they have support. Let them know they have allies. Let them know, you know, maybe there's got to be a group together that says allies of Indigenous people of Duke. What do we need? What do they need?
Mm.
You know, there's so much wealth around that area that it would not really dent anyone to have a house for the students there, like everyone else, and to have that opportunity, because most of those students go home and empower their communities, which the degree does not pay anything when they go home. The knowledge does, but there's no space for that degree. And so we take that knowledge that we learn at the universities and go home and try to help our people. That's what we do with our degrees. And it doesn't pay when you go home. I mean, for my degrees at home, there's no position for me unless it's minimum wage, because these are a lot of the tribes around the country are grant driven and still trying to surface economically. So protecting the land is not profitable for us. Extracting the land, we can become very wealthy, but that's not who we are.
Can you, returning to your experience at Standing Rock, can you describe, from how you personally experienced it, the spirit and the character of Standing Rock? From your film, I personally understood there to be great beauty and strength, even amidst this fight that was wrought with abuse and despair by what was happening and by the methods of violence that were being done onto the communities that were present.
I would say the synchronicity. You ever been around somebody that you just enjoy being around? You're like, wow, they just got awesome energy. And then you go around someone else who's just an energy vampire. You know, like negative Nancy. They're just like, they still might be your buddy, but they're like always negative. Energy's low and, you know, pessimistic. I would say like almost projecting the way they feel on you as well. The camp was like this synchronicity of we were on the same page, and people that came shared why they came. Some people said, I needed to be here. I don't know why, but my spirit brought me here. And I heard that thousands of times. We checked in. We had so many media passes and boxes that were gone within the week. We were going through them. Thousands of people were coming and going. And the synchronicity of support and solidarity and being humble and watching it and experiencing it was just beautiful for some people to be able to give back. And I saw people come. This one lady came and she had cancer, and her way of thinking was like, I came here to be in service and I came here to die with you guys. And I shared with her, I was like, I don't want you to die. I think you need to reverse your way of thinking, and you need to live and you need to see how we're living and protecting and enjoy this time to live. It's an amazing time to heal the energy here. So I don't want you to think about that, about dying. She sold everything and bought a large Sprinter, and she wanted to come and visit and watch us fly drones. And she was like, whatever I can do to help. And she was in her last stage of cancer. And she just talked about how beautiful it was waking up to hearing the morning prayers in the morning, the singing, the sunrise. And for her, it was just amazing to bring food And that was a story of many people: tend fire, make coffee, be in service to each other. The energy of that, no matter how much it looked bad on the other side, there was singing and laughing and eating together, equally dirty and stinky, you know, and some more than others. But that was the beauty of that energy that was there, that you could feel the world needed at that time, that kickstart that sacred fire in all the different directions. And all the tribes brought that in to a place that called out for help. Sandy Rock had called out for help. Their youth had called out for help. Their elders had called out for help. Their tribe had called out for help. And all those water protectors came in from all four directions. And song carriers came in from all four directions. Medicine people came in from all four directions. Healers came in from all four directions. Cooks. And the ask kept coming in. And the opportunity for people to show their support as an ally came in media, in news, in print, in podcasting, in ideas, in legal support, in traditional medicines. It was an amazing thing to experience and feel at that time, that there was so much sharing that I got to see that the impossible was possible. And no matter what they did to us on the other side, with dogs, with militia, with mercenaries, it grew and got stronger. They put a barricade up and Constantine wire across it, razor wire. It grew and grew. When they stood up on the hill during No Thanksgiving Day and on burial sites, that's coming up, it grew. The crowds grew and swelled. And no matter how much it hurt us, the strength of unity was more powerful than that. And as you had to be there to witness it. And sometimes you can feel the energy by just sharing it. But I seen that the impossible is possible. And even though that Cessna plane was 24/7 above camp, 24/7, every single day, every hour, it went around camp day and night, the helicopter day and night. That's what caused PTSD. That's what caused anxiety with many people that were there, and the constant harassment, the constant being pulled over and villainized and criminalized, and then taking of supplies. You know, and you go to camp and you're like, I'm sorry. I'd heard like many people say, I'm sorry. I came with a truckload of supplies and it was confiscated by Morton County. It was confiscated by Coz County. It was confiscated by some police. That was a story, but it was like, it's okay. We're okay. And there was an attacking on each other. And it was just a beautiful moment to see, no matter how bad it got, the solidarity was strong and thick every single day. And how can we do that today with the world? What can we learn from that point? And I think there is a lot to learn. That sacred fire went in all four directions. And it hit many people's spirit to empower them to do the same in their community and knowing their support.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today. Before we end the conversation today, is there anything that we haven't discussed or brought up that you would like to share?
Yeah, the Backwater Bridge, there's still accountability that needs to happen there with the human rights violations. Spraying water protectors when the water was definitely freezing icicles on the Constantine wire, and how many people were injured. Over 300 people were injured. And I think that needs to be brought and highlighted still. And as we start to heal and hold accountability, I think Americans, we could really use your help to hold some accountability to Kyle Kirschmeier, who is going out at that time for the last 4 years. We're talking 4 years now, training other officers and law enforcement to do what they did as a training ground out at Standing Rock. And we get, wherever he goes, there's like this level of violence that goes right after they've left. And as we see what's happened in Portland and Minneapolis and New York and different places, you can see it's the same tactics. Trained by militia mercenaries, domestic mercenaries. They were trained by them. which is actually there in Durham, Tiger Swan. And so that is the level of law enforcement we have now in our communities, where people are trying to protect from clean water, protect the communities from these camps that are known for missing, murdered Indigenous women, but to continue to educate, and allies that want to help, don't get discouraged with the trauma that we may be facing, because not all of us have that healing that is much needed. And so we're at different levels of healing and understanding what that means around us, because we've been through so much trauma. And it's not an excuse, it's a reality. And I'm not sharing on how we are victims. I'm sharing on the tactics used to victimize my relatives across the United States. And if we can understand that, educate, and hold space, then I think we can come together stronger. So thank you for this opportunity to share. And Pijatumia, sending blessings your way on your journey as well.
Thank you so much.
You just heard Indigenous filmmaker, journalist, digital storyteller, Myron Dewey, as part of the series Indigenous Voices at the Intersection of Social and Environmental Justice with host Anna Steltenkamp. Our regular show will resume on Monday, November 30th at 6 p.m. Until next time, folks, stay safe.